From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. We know that the internet and then radio and also friends are the best ways to find new music. But in my hand, I hold a book full of fresh ideas for things to hear. The book is called 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, and the author is Tom Moon. The book's an alphabetical compendium from ABBA to ZZ Top, with Bach and Monk in between. Each choice has a thoughtful description of the artist and their work, and more suggestions of things to hear by that artist. If you've been listening to the show, you've heard Tom Moon many times as a critic with a wide love of so much music. I was his editor for 10 years working on music reviews for All Things Considered, and his depth of knowledge always astonished me. But taking on a challenge like this, picking 1,000 recordings, seems almost beyond his scope. How the heck do you take on a task like this? I mean, where do you even begin organizing?
Where I started was just the world culture greatest hits kind of things, things that most people would agree should be in the time capsule. And I try to fill my ears with as many of those kinds of records as I could. That I'm thinking of things like Bob Dylan, Highway 61, the great Charlie Parker with Strings record, Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue, you know, the Beethoven symphonies, Bach's cello suites, things that most people would go, you know, we really do need to preserve that. Whatever the format is we're listening in, whatever kind of way music is delivered, we always want to make sure that music is available.
So you wrote those down, I assume, and you put them in a computer and started there?
Yeah.
Do you remember how many you came up with just from the obvious?
From the obvious, from the sort of no-brainer level, there were probably about 600 or 700.
Wow.
And you could have gone much further. Mm-hmm. And part of my thinking was, do I want this to only be those kind of records and or the rubber-stamped career critic and music scholar records that everybody would go, well, this isn't our favorite, but all the critics love this, so therefore it has to be there. Or, on the other extreme, I didn't want it to all be my favorites either.
But then there must have been that sort of discovery process where you say, I read this guy told me about this record, or I know this artist, I've heard of them. Tell me a CD, and let's get kicked off with some music here, of a piece of music you just didn't have a clue about that you said, whoa, how'd I miss that one?
There were a lot of those, in fact. One was the solo debut album from Lo Borges, a singer and songwriter and guitarist from Brazil. He collaborated with Milton Nascimento on the great Club de Esquina record that is also in the book. So this is Lo Borges on his own, and you know, you hear this, and he's making this in the early 70s, and you can tell that he's listening to everything that's happened in the U.S. and the U.K. over the last 5 or 6 years. So he's got the Beatles in his ears a little bit, he's got the Beach Boys in his ears, and he's made this very sort of solitary, kind of focused solo record, 15 songs that lasts about 30 minutes, and each one is just a little gem. A lot of them are only 2 minutes long, and they're just perfect little miniatures.
E perguntar por mim, não esqueça de dizer até amanhã, até amanhã, até amanhã. Não esqueça de sorrir como eu tentei sorrir quando alguém lembrar. Deixa o mundo virar para sempre. Oh. Oh. Oh.
você, ser você, amar você. Quando você ouve essa canção que eu fiz, não esqueça de sonhar. Até amanhã, até amanhã, até amanhã.
Because the world is round, it makes
yes,
me cry.
Exactly right.
Wow. That is great, Tom. I'd never heard of Los Borges. Is that how you say it?
Lo Borges.
The song title we had there?
Cansao Postal.
And the album?
It's just called Lo Borges. Mm-hmm. In Brazil, it's known as the sneaker album because on the cover, there's a pair of like old Adidas leather sneakers. but the whole thing is like that, and it just weaves together what he was contending with in Brazil with all this great pop music that we know from that had just sort of happened in the years before in just a dreamy, wonderful way. I love that record.
What else surprised you? It takes to another genre, maybe.
Yeah. What was interesting for a lot of records was you'd start with something you sort of knew, like in the case of a jazz record, you'd heard this guy as a sideman, and then you were like, well, what was his own records like? What did they sound like? Were they in that same style? And Booker Little, the trumpet player, had a very short career, but did turn up on a couple of records that I had sort of found in the course of casting a wide net for jazz records of the late 50s and early 60s. And he was a guy who never really had a big career in terms of the critics loving him, but he sat right on the cusp between what was happening in free jazz at the beginning with Ornette Coleman and what was happening in the sort of mainstream hard bop world. And he made a couple of great, great records. One of them is called Out Front, which was one of the great records Nat Henoff had some help, did some work with. And I think it came out on Nat Henoff's label, in fact. But this guy could play, and he had the great gift of being able to sort of transcend the free jazz language and the hard bop language.
Hmm. Play me something.
Okay, this is a song called We Speak, which is the way this album Out Front begins.
And the year?
That is 1961, so it's like that perfect great storm year where free jazz is just erupting and the Ornette Coleman thing is happening. And at the same time, you know, Miles Kind of Blue has only been out for a couple of years, so there's a lot going on in jazz in 1960, 1961.
Great. This is Booker Little. The dissonance is very easy to get into. I mean, it's very gentle.
Yeah, he's thinking a little bit like Wayne Shorter thought in his composition, where it's not hitting you over the head the whole time, and he's weaving in moments of great consonance into the dissonance, and there's nice contrast between the stuff that's really naughty and tense and then these passages that are more sort of placid. He also has a beautiful tone. He made four records, died of kidney failure at the age of 23, shortly after this record was done. And you just wonder what jazz would have been like had he been around for a little while, because a lot of people were watching out for Booker Little. Max Roach was a fan, and he had great support of a lot of the jazz people. So it was quite a tragedy to lose him.
I'm speaking with Tom Moon. Tom and I are old friends. Friends by distance, really, because we've known each other, 10, 12 years?
Yeah,
worked together,
a long time.
Doing pieces for All Things Considered all these many years, and of course on All Songs Considered as well. We've only met twice.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
In our long friendship. And the book is called 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. It's a great read. If somebody on email asked me, hey, Bob, what's a good music book to pick up? And I have enjoyed this music book more than most music books, and not only because of the content, but the writing, too. The way Tom has broken this book down, you go through it, it's alphabetical, and he'll tell you the artist and tells you which of the records are one of the 1,000 to hear, and oftentimes you may have more than one record by an artist. And then the cool thing, I thought, too, a really nice touch of this book. So after reading four or five paragraphs about the band, about the record they made, the context of making the record, and all that stuff, all the stuff you want to know in a nugget, you then go ahead and do things like, okay, what's the genre? What's the year? If you like this record, what's the next step? I'm just going to randomly just go to something in the book here, and it's in front of me, and pull up... For example, I'll pull up Buddy Holly, okay? So I just came across Buddy Holly, and it'll tell you the key tracks to listen to. And after Buddy Holly, the next step after that would be the Beatles, Meet the Beatles. And after that, maybe Marshall Crenshaw and John Lee Hooker, you know, which is just a page away. You'd say the record, it was released on Chess, and then you say the key tracks, Baby Please Don't Go. And then you'd say the next stop would be Howlin' Wolf, and Robert Cray would be after that. And the book is laid out like that, so you can just grow. If you like something, it's just easy to take on and grow. I think you did a really terrific job with a task that it's absolutely monumental.
Well, thank you. It was quite a great learning experience, though, and I would encourage everyone to make, you know, your listeners and certainly people who are engaged NPR listeners are already discerning about the music that they take in. And there was something really powerful about making a list of those and really sort of going, all right, what don't I know and where do I want to explore and what do I know and what really of my music that I know about belongs in the big time capsule. It's a great thing. There's a lot of clarity when you think about your mortality, I guess.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we open up a blog post, and we'll open up a blog post. Let people put, let's say, five records that they should hear. We'll keep it real, real easy. Five records that you know that someone else should hear before they die. And then if you happen to have Tom's book, maybe something that you got turned on to from the book. The battles will ensue, and I'm sure you've been bombarded by stuff. But let's pick some of the big acts and how you tackled some things like that. Because here's a couple. Let's start with Led Zeppelin. I was stunned by your Led Zeppelin choice. Look, I don't know that I could have chosen one record. I don't know if I could have chosen five records. I mean, I would have had to pick one through four, maybe, and then I probably would have had to pick one through six. Really,
six. Yeah.
So, but you didn't choose any of those. Tell us how you approached a catalog like Led Zeppelin's and boil it down.
Yeah, well, I did pick Led Zeppelin 2, which is the one where they're doing the most overt blues covers and blues appropriations, and it's that for me is like their sort of gem. The one thing that I think everyone who cares about rock and roll at some point has to interact with Led Zeppelin 2. But then my favorite record after that is Physical Graffiti. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of love for Led Zeppelin 4, which is the one with Stairway to Heaven. But for me, Physical Graffiti just goes in so many different places. It's the sound of it is so focused. And yet, I kept thinking, this band was so great live, and there was never a great live record until, while I was actually right before I started working on this project, they did release a DVD that's just called Led Zeppelin DVD, and then a corresponding album that actually has different live tracks from the DVD. That's called How the West Was Won. And what's interesting about How the West Was Won is it's the band at its peak playing live in settings that are good enough to where you actually get the sound of this band. And they were mighty. They were just bloodthirsty. There's nothing else like them live. And I felt like at the expense of two or three of the other studio records, which are also great, and I had to count on the fact that since we were sending people since we had a heading called Catalog Choice, and we're sending people to parts of the catalog that were not listed as entries, that I'd had to hope that they would find their way to Physical Graffiti and Four, and yet wouldn't miss this live record, which is really a treasure.
Should we play the 25-minute, 25-second version of Dazed and Confused, the 23-minute version of Whole Lot of Love, or the 19-minute and 23-second version of Moby Dick?
I really like that Whole Lot of Love. That is pretty great.
Because they interweave, was it some Everly Brothers?
Yeah.
In the middle. Well, pick us something to play, and we'll try. Some of these bands, especially the bigger ones, are harder to get rights to put the entire songs up. So let's see what we can do, but for most of these songs, we'll have full versions up on the website, npr.org/allsongs. There, too, you can find the link to the blog that we're talking about. What should we play?
Oh, boy. Yeah. That is a tough one because, you know, they are all super long. Well, what is and what should never be?
Okay.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
If I say to you tomorrow, take my hand, child, come with me, yeah. To a castle I will take you. What's to be, they say, will be. If you say to me tomorrow, oh, what fun it all would be, yeah. What's the step is pretty, baby. But what is and what should never be. And the wind tears dance.
I have to say that about 3 or 5 weeks ago, for no reason other than I just wanted to, I went through the entire Led Zeppelin catalog from beginning to end. And it was such a thrill. It was the greatest thrill ride I've had listening to music in a long, long time.
I believe it.
And I am embarrassed to say that I didn't know this album existed. I missed How the West Was Won completely. So I just got a copy of it, and I think maybe tomorrow.
It's a lot of fun, and the DVD is great too, for different reasons, of course. But seeing those guys, I never got to see them live. Seeing them and watching it happen, it's pretty great. Even in the footage from, you know, the days before 12 camera shoots of live shows.
Okay, so here's one I'll take you to task on. The Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
I mean, you knew you were going to get this stuff.
Yeah.
But the Rolling Stones, you picked two records. The first, many would agree with you on, which is Exile on Main Street. Yeah. I won't agree with you on that, but I'm in the minority on that record. I like that record. There are great moments on that record. But when it came out, I didn't even like the record when it came out. I've grown to love it over time, but not as much as, for me, Beggar's Banquet could be the one. It could be, Sticky Fingers. It could be Let It Bleed. And actually, in my twisted love of music, my actual very favorite Rolling Stones record is their Satanic Majesty's Request.
Wow.
That's an extraordinary record. But you picked The Exile on Main Street, and what was the other? You picked a...
The singles collection from the early years up through, essentially up through those three you mentioned, Sticky Fingers, Let It Bleed, Beggars. This is a three-disc singles collection that takes all the stuff they did for London and basically all the early singles. And it gives you the great B-sides, which are some of the blues things, Monkey Man, things like that. But it is kind of a weenie choice because and I've been taken to task by this by several of my critic brethren, and I must say they're right because I like the fact that I can represent with that one release a bunch of their great singles, and you can hear them in chronological order, the way they were issued as singles, and getting the B-sides. There's something great about that. However, those three records you mentioned, and I don't know which one I would pick, and I think this is probably, if I can beam myself back to my thought process about the Stones, it was that I couldn't pick out of Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, or Beggars. They're all three amazing records. They're all three somewhat different, but they form a triple play that we haven't seen since. In rock history, those three records taken together are as powerful as anything anybody ever did. And I'm completely remiss not having not representing one of them and talking about the three as a totality.
Let's play something from Exile on Main Street. Yeah?
You sure.
Do that?
Yeah.
And what do you want to pick?
Oh, boy.
Rocks.
You pick.
Rocks Off?
Hard to argue with that. Yeah,
it's quick, dirty, and gets right to the point. Okay. What did you love so much about this record? Why did you wind up picking it?
Because it has this great looseness. When I think of the Rolling Stones, I think of a band that's just swinging for the fences, and it can be raw. Not every hair is in place. There's not a choreographed element to it at all. And to me, this is the moment where the Stones are at their least choreographed and most sort of primal.
Can I play a Bob favorite of Bob?
Yes, absolutely. We need Bob favorites.
So... let me pick something off of Satanic Majesty's. Do you like that record at all?
Oh, I love that
Majesty's
record. Christmas. Yeah.
And what should I pick? We Love You was the cool single. That came on my iPod the other day, and I just absolutely was astonishing. Is that on the singles collection, do you know?
I got to believe it, because it was a single. Wasn't it?
Yeah. That's all it was.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So that's Leonard McCartney in the background singing on the harmonies, and it's all mocking. They had a big drug bust, and they were busted, so that's the jail noises that you hear on the doors, and it's what a great song. Oh, thank you for that. So let's go to something completely different. Let's Eric Satie makes it into the book. He has to have made it into the book.
Yeah.
But you chose a performance of Satie's music that I'd never heard.
Yeah, well, this is another one of these kinds of things you were asking about discoveries. One thing with classical music is the people who know it well, and I'm not one of them, I'm a generalist, but the people who know it well always talk about, oh, the interpretational differences are the whole game, and you really have to know, you know, four or five versions of a piece, and you start to hear what a conductor thinks, how a certain soloist approaches things. And sometimes that's really hard to actually brain out. But in the case of this record, I had listened to a couple of very well-respected solo pianists doing Satie's piano music and liked them fine. The music itself is just beautiful. It's very simple. It's almost like children's songs. It's like lullaby kind of vibe. And when I heard this pianist from the Netherlands named Reinbart de Leeuw, L-E-E-U-W is his last name, he totally opened up Satie for me. All of a sudden, these pieces, he takes them very slow. He plays them at almost a crawl. You don't even, you have trouble discerning where the tempo even is, but he just gets the essence of these melodies like nobody else I've ever heard.
Well, let's listen to some. This is, what do you want to play?
Let's hear the second one of the Gnosiennes, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right.
Gnosiennes.
The series of six pieces he wrote inspired by the island of Crete, and this is just, all of them are beautiful.
Good.
Any one of the six is beautiful, but if you hear another pianist play them, you'll often hear it much, much brisker than this version.
I think you've made somebody's commute just a absolutely memorable, beautiful. They probably missed their stop.
Well, I hope so. I'm transfixed by this, and it is partly because the music itself is so beautiful, but this rendition just really got me, and it made me think, boy, I need to learn how to listen better to all these kind of distinctions of interpretation. I tried to the rest of the way through the research on the book.
Now, I think, I'm not positive of this, but I think those pieces were written in the late 1880s. And Satie influenced, you know, someone like Brian Eno, for example,
yeah, totally.
So very much. And I only say that to make the next segue. Which is, when I got to the R's, I think I got through a good chunk of the letters, maybe Led Zeppelin, a good chunk of the letters without with going, yeah, Tom, that's good, yeah. But then when I hit Roxy Music, I think Roxy Music was my biggest disappointment in you, Tom.
Yeah.
So you chose Avalon, which is a record that came out when they were when they were done with.
Right. Second breakup. You know, sort of like the last gasp of the second iteration, I guess, or third iteration, depending on how you count.
And you left out all the two Brian Eno records that were done, the first two. Why don't you talk about what they're thinking of? And then, well, we'll play one from each. We'll play something maybe from the first Roxy. We'll play something from that. And then, you know, people can write you letters.
Yeah. Right. No, well, I mean, I like those for early Roxy records a lot. And they are very different from basically anything else that happened in music up till that point, I think. But then I hear the same thing with Avalon in a whole different way. I mean, you know, you have to, I guess what you have to be is someone who's going to like say, all right, Brian Ferry, whatever you think of him, if you like the vibe thing that he creates on Avalon, then you know, you can justify that choice. If you find him a little much, which I know many people do, and if his whole sort of persona as it comes across as a singer is a little too contrived, then the early records are the only choice. And he's not that way yet on those early records. He's not quite as sure of himself as a
absolutely,
you know, seductive male, for lack of a better term, or just as a singer. And it's quite interesting to hear him hear his evolution. And you know, in these choices, it was never to say this one, my choice of Avalon, was never to negate the rest of the catalog. It was more to say, you know, Avalon is a really interesting moment in pop music. It doesn't sound like anything else, and yet it has that wonderful warmth and richness of sound. It's like a warm bath, that record.
Well, play me something from Avalon, because Avalon, I may not have listened to the entire record, okay? So I could be not fair to the record, and you know. And I love Brian Ferry's voice. I've got every one of his solo records and still listen to him to this day. So
yeah, well, and how about his, you know, even some of the later things that he's done as a solo artist are pretty, you know, are pretty great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh boy, I don't know. I mean, you know, the single was more than this, and that's probably the best way to sort of evoke what they were doing at that time.
Okay. More than this, okay. Maybe I like it more than I thought I might. But
I want to hear what you pick for the first record.
Okay, yeah, it's a toughie. But
it is.
What I love about Roxy Music at their heart is when they sounded like they were all about to fall apart. It was all about to totally implode, and somehow it all stuck together. So I'll play what I think was their first single, "Virginia Plain."
Yeah,
and. I can't go wrong with this song.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Roxy Music, so that's Roxy Music's first record. Where do we go, Tommy? We got 1,000 things to think about, and about an hour to play with. What do you want people to hear that either surprised you or hands down you got to walk away and listen to this?
One of the records, I did a lot of canvassing in world music just because I believe that if I'm part of my target audience was a blank slate kind of listener, a newbie who's just coming of age in our era right now and wanting to explore and hopefully wanting to be curious about a lot of different kinds of music. And so part of my thinking was, what does that person need to know about in this very interconnected, hyperlinked world that we're in? And I kept coming up with back to the same few records, and one of them is Astor Piazzolla's classic Tango Zero Hour, which is one of his pieces for the new tango quintet that takes tango music into a realm of just the sublime. It's just an unbelievable record. And he made a bunch of, he was a great composer as well, a bandoneon player, so he has that sound characteristic, but as a composer, he took it well beyond where tango music, which we think of as sort of smoldering romantic music to begin with, he took it into a place of art that's unlike just about anything else. Well, let's hear just one of the miniatures from it. It's called Michelangelo 70.
That's Michelangelo 70. That's from Astor Piazzolla. And I'm talking with Tom Moon. 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die is a book, a great book. It's a listener's life list. Tom Moon, take us out on one song. Can you think of something that would rock us out here?
Oh, boy. Well, how about, Sister Rosetta Tharpe singing Down by the Riverside?
That would be a great way to go out. Sister Rosetta Tharpe, we know from a recent, the name people might know from a recent Alison Krauss and Robert Plant rendition of a song that's written by Sam Phillips, yeah? Why don't you tell us who Sister Rosetta Tharpe was?
She was a trailblazer of the 1940s. She was one of the first female guitarists who really had a fierce authority when she played. She played hard. She really dug in. She was a great soloist. There's videos on YouTube of her playing just in a frenetic way. And she was also a gospel performer. And so she sang gospel and played guitar in this way that was sort of right on the line between sacred and secular. And she totally understood jump blues and all the sort of upheaval of that was happening, like Louis Jordan and the other rhythm and blues stuff of the 1940s. And she integrated that with gospel in very hip ways.
Everybody knows this song, Down by the Riverside, for sure. And probably because, I mean, at least the performances I've heard of, maybe it was the old folk records that I heard. She was the one who did them.
Yeah.
Good rhythm guitar going on. She's great looking when you see her playing that electric rhythm guitar.
Yeah.
It's really quite a sight.
That's right.
From what record is this?
The best way I found to explore her catalog was in this series of records called Complete Recorded Works in Chronological Order, and the one that this is from 1938 to 1947.
Terrific. Thank you, Tom Moon.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, we may need to do a part two. What do you think?
Sure.
There's a whole lot more to talk about, and I haven't finished going through the book, so I might have some things I want to talk to you about.
Yeah, I'm into it anytime.
Great, and let's go out on Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Remember, we'll have a blog post up. Think of your five records. The five records you think your friends or people who you may come to meet would want to hear or should hear before they die. We'll put that on the All Songs Considered blog. Tom, is there a website also about the book?
Yeah, there sure is. It's www.1000recordings.com, and it's the numeral 1000.
Terrific. Tom Moon, be well.
You too. Thanks.
For NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered.
Wash my sins away. I'm going to lay down my heavy load down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm going to lay down my heavy load down by the riverside. Study war no more. I ain't going to study war no more. No, I ain't going to study war no more. No, no, I ain't going to study. Study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more. No, I ain't gonna study war no more. No, no, I ain't gonna study war no more. On my long white rope down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna try on my long white rope.